The U.S. Drought Monitor shows most of the state and the American West is in extensive drought just a few years after California emerged from a punishing multi-year dry spell. Officials fear an extraordinary dry spring presages a wildfire season like last year, when flames burnt a record 6,562 square miles, that is nearly 17,000 square kilometers. The declaration comes as Gavin Newsom prepares to propose more spending on short and long-term responses to dry conditions. The Democrat last month had declared an emergency in just two counties north of San Francisco, namely Mendocino and Sonoma. The expanded declaration includes the counties in the Klamath River, Sacramento, San Joaquin Delta, and Tulare Lake watersheds across much of the northern and central parts of the state. The Sierra Nevada snowpack, which provides about a third of the state's water, was just 59% of average on 1st of April, when it is normally at its peak. This year is unique in the state's recorded history because of extraordinarily warm temperatures in April and early May, the Biden administration said. That led to quick melting of the Sierra Nevada snowpack in the waterways that feed the Sacramento River, which in turn supplies much of the state's summer water supply. The problem was worse because much of the snow seeped into the ground instead of flowing into rivers and reservoirs, the administration said. The warmer temperatures also caused water users to draw more water more quickly than compared to other drought years, the administration said, leaving the reservoirs extremely low for farmers, fish, and wildlife that depend on them. That all reduced the state's water supplies by as much as what could supply up to 1 million households for a year, officials said. It's time for Californians to pull together once again to save water, Wade Crawford, secretary of the California Natural Resources Agency, said in a statement. Crawford urged residents of California to limit their use, whether by limiting outdoor watering, checking for leaks, or taking shorter showers and turning off the water taps when washing dishes or brushing teeth. California Governor Gavin Newsom declarations directs the State Water Board to consider changing the rules for reservoir releases and water diversions to keep more water upstream later this year to maintain more water supply, improve water quality, and protect cold water pools for salmon and steelhead. The declaration also allows more flexibility in regulations and contracting to respond to the drought, while speeding voluntary transfers of water between owners. Recently, officials in California decided to use a fleet of trucks to transport more than 15 million young salmon raised at fish hatcheries in the state's Central Valley agricultural region to the Pacific Ocean, because projected river conditions showed that the waterways the fish normally use to travel downstream will be historically low and warm due to increasing drought. Officials announced a huge trucking operation, saying the effort is aimed at ensuring the highest level of survival for the young salmon on their hazardous journey to the Pacific Ocean. California is now in its second year of drought after a winter with little precipitation, and it is the state's fourth driest year on record, especially in the northern two-thirds of the state, according to the California Department of Water Resources. Illustrating the state's risk of drought, Record low reservoir levels led the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, to proclaim a regional drought emergency for the Russian River watershed in Sonoma County and Mendocino County last month. California's native Chinook salmon need cold water to survive, but dams have blocked their historic retreats to the chilly upper reaches of Northern California's Sacramento River tributaries. The fishing industry and Central Valley farmers are in a constant struggle over the same river water to sustain their livelihoods, with fish supporters lobbying for higher river water levels, and farmers, on the other hand, against it so that they can draw water to irrigate their crops.
Inside Israel.
It's getting ever so hard to marry in Israel. Many Israelis are not allowed to marry in Israel. Simply put, there is no civil marriage in Israel. Others simply opt to not have a religious marriage, marry outside of Israel. But now with the coronavirus pandemic, they cannot do that either.
All right, so now we're talking a lot about Jewish law as well and how that pertains to marriage. How do marriage and divorce laws work in Israel? Because it isn't only Jewish law here.
That's a great question. In most Western countries, the authority to judge matters relating to divorce is in the hands of the family court. But here in Israel, marriage and divorce are under the jurisdiction of both the rabbinical court and the family court. So the legal systems of both of these courts are authorized to take care of these matters regarding divorce. So unfortunately, where they overlap gets really murky.
In Israel, marriage can only be approved by religious rabbinate courts. Also, marriage must be based on the Jewish religion. However, not all Israelis, according to the chief rabbinate, are Jewish, including immigrants and converts, among others. This has been the case since 1947. The generations then understood. But now, the younger generations, and with the influx of Soviet immigrants, things are changing, and not necessarily for the better. Israelis who cannot marry are having a hard time leaving Israel to do so. In Israel, there are no marriage registrations for Israelis who opt for a non-religious ceremony or those turned away by the rabbinate. Usually, thousands of Israelis in Israel who cannot marry under religious Israeli law do so outside of Israel. But this year, the coronavirus pandemic has prevented many from doing so. In Israel, there is no such a thing as civil marriage or divorce. Israel allows marriages to be held only under religious law, banning those who cannot or will not comply with the rabbi's demands from marrying. This is because marriage and divorce, among others, are under the jurisdiction of the courts of the chief rabbinate in Israel. Ultimately, this entity gets to decide what or who is Jewish and what or who is not. Under the chief rabbinate's orders, converts, non-Jews, and immigrants cannot marry in Israel. Under Israeli law, marriage and divorce resides with religious authorities, but a growing number of couples have opted not to involve the rabbinate in their personal lives. The rabbinate is run by Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews who abide by legislation held over from the days of Ottoman rule over pre-1948 Palestine. In 1947, David Ben-Gurion, later the first prime minister of Israel, and the religious parties, which many of them were there before the influx of the white Jewish European settlers, reached an agreement that included an understanding that matters of personal status in Israel, which included marriage, would continue to be determined by religious authorities. This arrangement has been termed the status quo agreement and has been maintained despite numerous changes of cabinets ever since.
Well, you see, Israel is not a theocracy, although religion has a very powerful role. It was envisioned in the early days of the state in 1948, it was envisioned as a liberal society. But because it is a Jewish state, because the religious minority in Israel was not ready to define it completely as a secular institution, so the rabbinate has a very important role in Israel. It is part of the government. So it's not a private affair of people. The rabbinate in Israel, like in many other countries in which religion plays a prominent role, Israeli rabbis are actually government officials. They get a salary from the government. They are like a bureaucrat of the state. So marriage, because it is a very important civic institution, it is run by religious people. That's the situation in Israel. You can marry without a rabbi, but your marriage is not exactly the same thing in terms of your relations with the government. So that's the situation. Well, what people used to do, those people who did not want to marry with a rabbi and did not want to have a religious marriage, the only option was to go and marry in civic religion outside of Israel. Usually people would go to Cyprus, and then somebody like a municipal official will marry them, because there are two mature people. They come and say, we want to marry, and then there is a civic agreement, and they can marry, and they can come back to Israel, and their marriage would be recognized as civic marriage. But now nobody can do that, or very few can do that, because nobody goes to Cyprus now. There is another option in Israel that people can marry, because you see, the Jewish marriage are defined in such a way that if you have your spouse you want to marry, the only thing you have to do is you have to stand with in the company of others who are witnesses and say that you are ready to marry this woman, and she is ready to marry you, and you basically have done the social ritual of marriage. You don't need a rabbi. But in Israel, in order to get all the benefits from the state as a married couple, you have to be registered in the rabbinate. But basically, you can marry your loved one, the person you love, without any problems. There are many people who marry without the official that a rabbi officiate the marriage. You can do that. These are not kind of, they are almost civic marriage, but they are not in the same status. So there is some vague boundaries between the different arrangement for marriage in Israel.
The rabbinate inside Israel is very powerful, very, very powerful. They don't let to bring other laws into the state of Israel, because from the beginning of the state of Israel, they made a deal with the Zionist states, with Ben Gurion, to have the power of marry the couples. And so they had an agreement when they founded this Zionist state. Even the Zionist state was not a religious state. They religion with Zionism. At the beginning, the Jewish religion, the religious Jews were against the Zionist state. The Zionist state was founded by non-religious Jews. So then it came a mixture between religious Jews that wanted to found these Zionist states, and they created a symbiosis between religion, Jewish religion, and Zionism and Zionist political ideas. But that's not the original Jewish religion, and it was not also the Zionist project. It is a mixture of both. Well, it could be if they have a government that doesn't include rabbis or rabbinical parties, I mean religious parties, like the Shas. If they have an election and they make a deal with all the parties that are not religious, they could make something to change the law.
Yes, we have that problem. This is it was in the beginning a small problem. It was a problem that some people can say this is not really happened, but today we know this is a big problem. I am a friend in a group in Israel of lawyers and professor in law, and this is what we do. We speak about that and we do some action to stop that. I don't think we can stop that now because it's so big. But maybe we can a little bit put the light on action that happened and put the woman outside over and over again all the time. I think now in Israel we stay in very bad situation. I think we go backward, and I think that a lot of people want to say this is like religion people that make that problem, but this is not only religion people, and it's not all of the religion people. This is a group of people that they have an interest, and this is what they want to do.
Currently, thousands of couples are not able to get married at all, since going abroad is not an option due to the coronavirus pandemic, and the chief rabbinate will not perform a ceremony and provide legal recognition. The rabbinate standards and interpretations in these matters are generally used by the Israeli Interior Ministry in registering marriages and divorces. This legislation is amenable to the rabbinic establishment only. Many Israelis find they are turned away by the rabbinical authorities on the basis of Jewish law. Among them come from families who have immigrated to Israel from former Soviet republics and cannot provide the rabbinate with a required proof of their Judaism. Throughout the decades, there have been attempts to change the law. One such way as allowing civil marriages to be held by foreign governments under embassy ground. This had been thwarted by religious political parties that have historically held the deciding vote in coalition cabinets in Israel. Long before the coronavirus pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Israelis found themselves searching for options that included travel abroad or entering contractual cohabitation agreements just to validate their love and desire for family. For many Israelis, it has been and remains unacceptable that a person who is a citizen of Israel, a productive and law-abiding member of society, still does not have the most basic right to marry in Israel. This is why many are now calling for full civil marriage in Israel, which does not require any contact with the rabbinate for those who do not want it.
Well, the official government personnel will not help them very much, because in Israel, in order, for example, a young couple get married, if they want to go and get, let's say, mortgage to buy their first home from the government, some kind of assistance, they would not be able to do that because they are not recognized as a married couple. Okay? But for any practical purposes, they can be married. And there is a special status for people like that. For example, a man and a woman can live together, and they are, for all practical purposes, are married if they live together and they share their life. They don't need the official stamp. But if you need some official assistance from the government, for example, in questions of will and a question of inheritance and a question of buying a house and all that, so the government intervenes and it says, no, if you want our support, the government support, you need to be married according to our rule. And our rule are religious rules. That's the situation in Israel. So to some extent, it is a very troubling situation. Many people don't like it. Many people don't want the rabbi intervene in their life. Because, for example, if you want to divorce later on, you have to do it with some agreement of the rabbinate. Well, the rabbinate is a very powerful institution, but you see, it is not, its power is not unlimited. It is quite limited, but they are very powerful. Why? Because they command and they control civic relations that people are so important for people, the question of marriage. Because you see, because Israel is defined as a Jewish state, Judaism has a very profound role in the political arrangement of the country. So the political parties, who are religious parties, throughout the years were national system, but also in the religious sphere. So they are very powerful, but not unlimited force. The civil authorities also can limit their power. Yes, they can, but it depends on what issue. For example, we have in Israel the issue of religious young people who study in religious institutions do not serve in the army. And many people resent that because they think that if you are a citizen, like everybody else, you have to pay taxes, you have to work, and you have to serve in the army like everybody else. In Israel, now it's quite a sizable minority of people who do not work and they study. And what they call that their studies is their work, because they study religious things. And the political parties who are religious parties defend this, their right not to serve in the army and not even to work, and that's especially a privilege for males, not so much for females. So there are many twists and many interesting things that have developed in Israel that were not that like that in Jewish communities before the state of Israel.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Ron Miretti says, as a Jew, this rabbinate bothers me. No one should be able to tell me I'm not Jewish enough. You want to continue to lose internal support? That's how you do it. Angry Dad says, Israel is now largely statutory, and there are specific laws putting family law matters, including matrimonial and divorce, in the jurisdiction of the rabbinate.
They have to go to another country. But I heard that it's a new that the Norwegian from Norway government made a deal, a solution that they could marry by civil law in their embassy in Israel, so they don't have to travel to other countries to do that. That could be to Arabs, immigrants, not religious people, LGBT community, etc., etc. You know, this law in Israel, it's a mixture of secular law inherited by the British rule. The British inherited all the law except the marriages, the civil law for the marriages and the family law. So it is a mixture. It is not a theocratical law. It is not a democratically law. It is some mixture. So it has to be a solution to help all these people who wants to marry and make some changes in this kind of mixture law between religious and secular judges.
Norway has offered to allow Israelis to get civil marriages at their embassy and consulate, as coronavirus restrictions have prevented them from traveling to Cyprus. Cyprus is a common destination for civil marriages. The issue is being debated, but it's not new. The concept of allowing Israelis to marry on foreign embassy grounds has been proposed before, but religious political parties did not allow it then. And now many believe that they will not allow it to happen, even in these distressful, uncertain times. This is why many in Israel despise the rabbinate. More and more Israelis are calling for its disbandment. Of course, that would be highly unlikely, as it is too powerful and it's essentially part of the Israeli regime. For now, Israelis just can't have a civil marriage.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The Month of God. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with the last episode of the special series for Ramadan. The month of Ramadan was the best period for attaining proximity of God through obeying His commands. The Noble Quran in many ayahs calls on us to be hopeful of God's mercy and forgiveness. Ayah 87 of Surah Yusuf, for instance, reads, "Do not despair of Allah's mercy. Indeed, no one despairs of Allah's mercy except the faithless lot." In view of this, despair of God's mercy is one of the greatest sins in Islam. Hope is a valuable gift from God. Hope and optimism strengthen positive thinking in human being, and positive thinking will double man's motive to continue life with more energy. Such a person will make this utmost effort to reach lofty goals. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "I swear by the one which there is no God but him, that the goodness of the world and the hereafter will not be attained by a faithful unless through optimism, hoping God's favor, good morals, and refraining from backbiting the faithful." Eid al-Fitr is the first day of the Islamic month of Shawwal and one of the greatest Islamic feasts. Fasting is haram or religiously forbidden on this day. In fact, it is the day of thankfulness to God for fasting the blessed month of Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Adorn your feast with takbir, saying, Allahu Akbar." In another hadith, he is narrated as saying, "Adorn the feast of Fitr and Adha with La ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar, walhamdulillahi wa subhanallah." The end of the 1 month of fasting is a joyous gift from God, which is manifested in Eid al-Fitr. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "When the crescent of the month of Shawwal appears, the angels raise their voices, saying, O faithful, come and receive your gifts." Imam Ali, peace upon him, also says, "Know that the nearest thing that has been made for the faithful men and women is that, on the last day of the month of Ramadan, an angel calls on behalf of God, O servants of God, take this good news that God has forgiven your past sins. So think on your future a new life as how you will live. In the last episode of this series, let us recite the special supplication of Imam Sajjad for bidding farewell to the month of Ramadan. Farewell to you, the best companion of times. Farewell to you, the best month in days and hours. Farewell to you, the month in which the aspirations neared and the good deeds increased. Farewell to you, the companion whose being is valuable and whose loss is sad, and the source of hope whose departure is painful. Farewell to you, the companion whose coming causes calm and whose going is horrible. Farewell to you, the neighbor in which the hearts were softened and the sins decreased. Farewell to you, as you brought us blessings and washed away the pollution of our sins. Farewell to you, while we have no grudge from you or any bitterness of your fasting. Farewell to you, that we desired you before your coming and sad before your departure. Farewell to you and your night of Qadr, which is better than 1,000 months. Farewell to you, as we were so attached to you yesterday, and we will be so eager to you tomorrow. O God, we are the people of this month whereby you ennobled us and helped us with your favor, while the wretched ignored it and were deprived of its grace due to their misery. And it is you who has chosen us for its recognition and guided us for its tradition. And indeed, you have been our patron in helping us to fast and pray in it. Although we have come short in it and fulfilled little of much, O God, all praises belong to you. While we admit our evil deeds and confess our destructive acts, while we are remorseful in our hearts and apologize you with honest tongues, so for the shortcoming that we have done in this month in relation to your obedience, reward us in a way that we achieve desirable grace and attain various savings that we have been yearning for. And accept our apology in shortcoming to fulfill your right and prolong our life till the next month of Ramadan. And when we reach the next Ramadan, help us worship you as it behooves you and take us to the position that behooves your obedience and make us do the deeds that will fulfill your right in this Ramadan and the next one. O God, bless Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad, and compensate for our calamity of departure of our month, and bless us in your feast and breaking the fast, and make it among the best days that have lapsed and brought your pardon and removed our sins.
Around the World with Reporters.
Hundreds of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. This was the latest in a series of confrontations in the Holy City. Palestinian worshippers gathered at the mosque's courtyard after performing morning prayers to prevent a planned raid by Israeli settlers later Monday as part of their activities to mark what they call Jerusalem Day. It's the day when East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, was occupied in 1967 and later annexed by Israel. Israeli forces raided the courtyards, firing tear gas, stun grenades, and rubber bullets against Palestinians to force them out of the holy site. However, the Palestinians remained steadfast.
What is going on in Al-Quds is a massacre, a comprehensive war to evacuate the city from its real residents. Palestinians across the world don't remain silent. People in Al-Quds are clashing with the occupation forces to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They will never allow the settlers to desecrate their holy site.
After the clashes, Israeli forces decided to change the path of the Jerusalem Day flag march, so the settlers had to march through the old town's streets. The latest confrontations follow days of clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the Jerusalem Al-Quds. The clashes escalated with the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, after Israel tightened its grip on the city and prevented the Palestinians to freely perform their religious duties. Palestinians demand immediate action from Arab states. They say the only appropriate response to the crimes is immediate halt of any ties with the Zionist entity.
First of all, the Palestinian leadership must cancel any agreement with the Israeli regime. Then he should call on the Arab states to stop any effort to normalize ties with Israel. We want urgent measures by the international community to stop the bloodshed in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The tension has also been fueled by an eviction plan in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds, where Israeli settlers have waged a lengthy battle to take over Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts to forcefully evict Palestinians from their homes in Al-Quds. Israel's Supreme Court was to hold a hearing on the eviction on Monday, but the session was postponed due to the unrest in Al-Quds. Israeli violence has sparked international condemnations. Meanwhile, the UN chief has urged Israel to exercise maximum restraint and respect the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. Amid soaring tensions in Jerusalem Al-Quds, which has seen weeks of clashes, the Israeli authorities question whether a new uprising can now be inevitable. Unabating protests across the occupied territories have proved that Jerusalem Al-Quds is a red line for Palestinians, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
No more silence. Say a word. Pro-Palestine activists gathered outside the UN office in Tehran to demand that the United Nations take action with regards to Israel's expulsion of Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah and other areas in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mostly student, the protesters called the Israeli move barbaric and against all international laws.
I'm here to support Palestinian rights. As for the recent crimes against humanity, these aren't recent. These have been around for a long time. It's more than, nearly 70, 75 years that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine has been an ongoing process. This needs to stop. And more people need to stand up to Israel and to the crimes that they're committing. We need to talk about this and we need to stop this.
We have come here to voice our solidarity with and support to our brothers and sisters in Palestine and to condemn the inhumane behavior of the Israeli regime against Palestinians. We regard the UN silence as complicity in the crimes committed by Israel.
Israeli forces have over the past days been attacking Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds, Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, trying to force the Palestinians to abandon their residences in an attempt to make way for the construction of new illegal settlements. The regime has so far wounded dozens of Palestinians protesting against the decision made by an Israeli court.
During the past days, we have witnessed heinous crimes against the innocent Palestinian people by Israel. It's interesting that the U.S. claims to be the defender of human rights. I wonder why is Joe Biden keeping mum and not condemning the Israeli violence? Where did all the human rights slogans go?
Israel has for seven decades been pressing ahead with the construction of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories and continues to deny millions of Palestinian refugees the right to return. Several attempts have been made to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the last of which was the so-called deal of the century, proposed by ex-U.S. President Donald Trump, which is dismissed by Palestinians as an attempt to trade their identity and history with money.
Rights activists here say Israel's recent atrocities are a proof that the so-called peace plans by the West cannot defend the rights of Palestinians and will only make the Israeli regime more insolent in its crimes in Palestine. Protesters say it's time to take action, as any silence by the international community is tantamount to a green light to Israel's violence against Palestinians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A lot of work is needed and time is limited. That's what Joseph Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, has told a ministerial meeting in Brussels with respect to ongoing talks in Vienna to try and save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
It's an effort to make the US to go back to the agreement in order to have a full compliance for Iran, which is the best way to ensure the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran nuclear program.
Tehran insists it has zero ambition to build a nuclear bomb. The idea that Iran wants a nuclear weapon is peddled by Tel Aviv and the Israel lobby in the US, according to unbiased security experts.
Where is the evidence, they ask? How many times has Washington launched attacks on foreign nations without any justification?
Critics say the West's meddling in the Middle East has caused immeasurable damage.
Well, the biggest failing of all was the, you know, intervention of the United States into Iraq, after 9/11, because this created a security vacuum.
EU and US foreign policy was recently debated in the European Parliament.
We must work for stability in Iran and Iraq and Lebanon, a peace in Syria and Yemen, and oppose the US-Saudi attempts to isolate Iran.
The Iran nuclear agreement, underpinned by the UN, was thrown into flux when Donald Trump pulled the US out of the accord 3 years ago this month. He then imposed harsh, illegal economic sanctions on Iran. Saving the nuclear deal would help to bring stability to the region, it has been suggested.
You know, Middle East, it is a vital area. We should to make it a quiet area because, you know, it is on the middle of the trade road, so it will affect all the economy situation in all the world.
Joseph Borrell has told EU foreign affairs ministers the talks in Vienna, Austria, are extremely delicate, sensitive and intense. He says he's optimistic and a window of opportunity will stay open until the end of this month. Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, he insists. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
According to the spokesperson of Taliban, the group's leadership has ordered all members to stop fighting during the 3 days of Eid al-Fitr that mark the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
Taliban also say the group's leader has ordered all members not to enter government-controlled areas during the three-day ceasefire and that they would not allow government troops to get into Taliban-controlled areas in the same period.
The declaration of three-day ceasefire by the Taliban has been widely welcomed in Afghanistan. Locals who are bearing the brunt of violence say they expect the Taliban to agree to a permanent ceasefire in the hopes that it would lead the country to a lasting peace.
Nonetheless, we welcome the three-day ceasefire by the Taliban, but I think temporary ceasefires are not viable long-term options to put an end to our misery. So we want the Taliban to approve a lasting ceasefire instead of insisting on war.
Taliban approved the three-day ceasefire as Afghanistan witnessed a sharp increase in civilian deaths due to rising terrorist attacks such as car bombs or explosions over the recent months. On Saturday, three separate heavy explosions went off close to a girls' school in western Kabul. 68 civilians were killed, most of them young girls. Also, over 160 others were wounded in the incident. This grim attack occurred just 2 days before the Taliban militant group declared the Eid ceasefire. Meanwhile, many have called on international players to put pressure on the Taliban to approve a permanent ceasefire.
The ceasefire is good news for us, but our oppressed people deserve lasting calm and security as they have tolerated a decades-long bloody war. Therefore, some foreign states who had promised us to bring peace in our country must fulfill their obligation.
This is not the first time the Taliban approves a short-term ceasefire since it was removed from power back in 2001. In June 2018, the Taliban approved a three-day ceasefire. During that period, Some Taliban militants entered Kabul and even took photos by Afghan armed troops. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Here at the Higher Constitutional Court, the final list of those eligible to participate in Syria's presidential elections has been announced. This comes after a week from the initial announcement, which was a period of time given for objections, which reached six. All have been declined.
The court rejected all objections due to the lack in the legal and constitutional terms of their applications. Thus, the final announcement is as follows. The court has accepted Abdullah Abdullah, Bashar al-Assad and Mahmoud Meri as the final candidates in the upcoming presidential elections.
Abdullah Abdullah is a former MP and Mahmoud Meri is a Syria-based opposition figure. According to the court, candidates are allowed to start campaigning on the 16th of May. 10 days before the date of the elections in Syria. However, individuals and even public and private bodies have already filled the streets of President Assad posters in a wide show of support that indicates who is likely to win. Presidential elections this year are different from any previous ones from many aspects.
I expect a large participation by voters this year because so many parts of the country have become secure and under government control. We have three candidates and Syrians will decide who the winner is.
Previous elections were more difficult from today during the war because of terrorist mortar attacks. Today I see Syrians more excited to take part in elections and vote.
This is an unprecedented election process in Syria's history, as for the first time, more than 50 persons applied to become a candidate, among them women. In April, the People's Assembly officially announced the date of the elections, including the terms that should be met for those who wish to run, which included the votes of at least 35 MPs. All eyes are on the presidential elections in Syria, a process carried out according to the country's constitution. Despite the fact that so many countries known for their hostility to Syria are against the elections, the Syrian government is keen to abide by the law and send a message that only the Syrian people are entitled to decide the future of their country. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow consistently defends international law and at the same time will firmly defend its national interests to ensure the safety of its people. He made the remarks during a speech to thousands of soldiers and veterans on Red Square during the annual parade, which marked the 76th anniversary of victory in the World War II.
Our people know too well how this can end. Russia is consistently defending international law while continuing to protect our national interests and the security of our people. Our guarantees are the glorious Russian armed forces, descendants of the victorious troops, and of course our joint efforts for the sake of our country's development and the well-being of Russian families.
Vladimir Putin voiced concern over what he described as a creeping return of ideologies of the time when slogans of racial and national superiority, of anti-Semitism and Russophobia became even more cynical.
Unfortunately, attempts are made to deploy a large part of Nazi ideology and the ideas of those who were obsessed with the delusional theory of their own supremacy. This ideology is not only supported by radicals and international terrorist groups of all kinds.
The parade was participated by more than 12,000 troops, 191 units of military ground equipment and 76 planes and helicopters. Military parades and festive events commemorating the Soviet victory took place in almost all Russian cities.
I consider the Victory Day as the greatest holiday of Russia. Many Russians lost their life to liberate Europe. Victory is victory, and it was very, very difficult. This is a great day for the Soviet people. Our republics of the Soviet Union won a great victory. Some powers are seeking to distort history. They say that the victory was won by the Americans, French, or Britons. It's a lie.
This year's parade comes at a time when Moscow's relations with the West are severely strained over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine and the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned last week that relations between the Kremlin and Washington could plunge to the Cold War level if Washington continued to reject dialogue with Moscow.
Moscow.
The Soviet Union lost about 27 million people, 40% of all human losses in the World War II. A significant part fell on the civilian population of the country. According to the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission for the Establishment and Investigation of the Atrocities of the German Fascist Invaders, about 2,000 cities and towns, over 70,000 villages in the USSR were completely or partially destroyed by the occupiers. Марина Картунова, Москва.
Administered Kashmir witnessed the death of one of its prominent pro-freedom leaders in an Indian-run jail this week. Ashraf Zahrai's death has raised concerns about the scores of political prisoners languishing in Indian prisons as the country combats a fresh surge in coronavirus cases and deaths. That's amid testimonies by members of the 78-year-old's family who said he died due to lack of health care and improper prison conditions after he tested positive for coronavirus. Now families of other political prisoners fear they could also face Sehrai's fate. The father of the 19-year-old Seher Shabir has spent 33 years of his life in different Indian detention centers. Shabir Shah is in prison for actively supporting Kashmir's right to self-determination.
My father's health conditions are not really good, and I and my family fare a lot in this case because he's having already many serious health ailments, and his life is in danger because we can't take the risk right now as COVID is increasing day by day and he has been denied treatment. Also, apart from all this, we have no contact with him.
Seher's father is among scores of Kashmiris who are imprisoned for supporting the region's independence from Indian rule. They are incarcerated under India's Public Safety Act, a preventive detention act that authorizes detention of any person for up to 3 months without a trial, and the detention period is extendable. Rights groups say the law has often been exploited to keep pro-independence supporters behind the bars. Human rights activist Ehsan Untu was also jailed recently. He says the central government has made it difficult to bail prisoners out.
The treatment of Kashmiri political prisoners in India is unfair. We are often kept with the criminals and are denied basic health care and medical attention. The entire setup is against Kashmiri prisoners. Even courts do not hold fair hearings. The international community must take action, otherwise no Kashmiri will walk alive from Indian jails.
Due to the raging pandemic last year, India's top court handed the decision to release prisoners on interim bail to the powerful state committees. Around 45,000 prisoners were released under the guidelines. However, not many of them were from among Kashmiri political prisoners. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Tens of thousands in Paris, more than 100,000 all over France, took the street in a massive protest against the climate law voted earlier this week in the French Parliament. The demonstrations took place in a festive atmosphere with a lot of colors and animation and with a lot of young people coming from different social backgrounds. The awareness is rising and more people are getting convinced that significant measures have to be taken to save the planet. But that's not what the French authorities are doing, they say.
This law is ridiculous because the President of the Republic promised 150 climate measures. Finally, only 29 were retained. Regarding domestic flights, thermic efficiency of apartments and renewable energies, this is really the minimum of the minimum. Our group in the Senate will oppose this law next month. We are going directly to a catastrophe if more urgent measures are not taken.
Earlier this week, the French Parliament voted a climate law after 110 hours of debate, a record. The main points of the law are ban of domestic flights if the distance can be done by train in less than 2 hours, ban of renting very poorly isolated apartments, stimulating the use of especially electrical bicycles. But this is far from being enough for the more than 600 associations who organized these marches and who consider French President Macron responsible for the passivity on climate issues.
Aerial planification should be made to leave the nuclear energy behind us and to invest in renewable energy. This government does not have a budget for the thermic isolation of poorly isolated apartments, and it should really ban domestic flights and develop transport by train instead of privatizing the public transport. There should be taxes on big multinationals to create thousands of jobs in the development of renewable energy. Even Joe Biden in the USA has proposed these kinds of measures.
The High Council for the Climate, an independent body, declared that the French measures are insufficient to reduce greenhouse gases. The European Union as well is strengthening its ambitions to halt global warming. So, time for France to increase its objectives. But to succeed, the French authorities will have to hurt the big bosses of the nuclear and the petrol industry. It is not sure that they are willing to go that far. Too little and maybe too late. That's the main sentiment here concerning the climate measures taken by the French Parliament.